Hello, my name is Eric Jorgensen from the Maine Humanities Council, and it's my pleasure to welcome you to another in our series of podcasts exploring the power and pleasure of ideas in Maine. This is a presentation from the University of New England's Center for Global Humanities Lecture Series, which each year brings speakers representing the best of the humanities to Portland.
Good afternoon, folks. I'm so happy that you're here. I have the pleasure of introducing Christopher Corbett and Colin Sargent. And the book that they have worked on is From Far East to Old West. It's True Tales of the American Frontier. Christopher Corbett writes about what historian Bernard DeVoto calls the borderland of fable, that place in our American West where fact and fantasy collide. His books on the legacy of the Pony Express and the opening of the West by the Chinese provide vivid examples of tales of truth, half-truth, and of course, no truth at all. And that postcard you have is from him with the Pony Express on it. Colin Sargent is drawn to outsiders, denied a voice in our national mythology, according to the Boston Globe. His book, Museum of Human Beings, is a picture of Jean-Baptiste Charbonnet. Isn't that how you pronounce his name?
Well, our lecture is about anything goes.
Okay, yes. All right. His struggle, Sacagawea's son, struggle to emerge from the shadow of his celebrity mom, Sacagawea, and she was the guide for the Lewis and Clark expedition. Batista's quest for acceptance strikes a chord, and the plight of modern-day rich and famous offspring, such as Sheila McCartney or musician Mr. Dylan's son, Jacob. So I'd like to introduce the two gentlemen.
Well, thank you very much for coming down here, and it's warm in this room, so if you feel that you need a glass of water, which is apparently all we can offer you, you should jump right up and get one. Can you hear me? Yes?
Yes.
This is the 150th anniversary of the Central Overland California and Pikes Peak Express Company. And if the name seems too unwieldy, then you should call it what Americans called it from the day it began, the Pony Express. It occurred to me after I wrote this book for Random House that I could have actually made a great deal more money betting people in bars how long the Pony Express was in business, because no American ever got it right. That'll be my gift to you today. The Pony Express only lasted for 78 weeks. It hemorrhaged money from the day it began, never made a dime, but it is among the most enduring and endearing memories of the 19th century West. People who do not speak a word of English can tell you what Pony Express means. In fact, in Czechoslovakia, there are Pony Express clubs where people dress up like the Marlboro Man and pretend to have been in the Pony Express. Americans are often curious about the history of the Pony Express. It was a fast mail service which was started by a successful freight hauling firm called Russell, Majors & Waddell. And it began business on the 3rd of April, 1860, and it went out of business on October 24th, 1861, in the flash of a telegrapher's key, having made no money at all. And one of the principals actually almost went to prison for their debts. People in the Old West believed that the initials of the firm, COC and PP, meant clean out of cash and poor pay, for they were legendary for not paying their bills. And the reason that we remember the Pony Express on its 150th anniversary is because of two Americans. The first was a Confederate Army deserter who was going west in the summer of 1861, and from the top of a stagecoach in western Nebraska, he saw the rider of the Pony Express. He would call him later the Swift Phantom of the Desert, flash past his coach. And writing entirely from memory, 10 years later, having not taken a single note, Mark Twain would get a whole chapter of Roughing It out of that experience. And he would not let the facts get in the way of the story. He would be soon followed by another American who was not unfamiliar with the golden age of prevarication. That would be Buffalo Bill Cody. Bill Cody put the Pony Express in his show from the day it opened in Omaha, Nebraska in the spring of 1881 until the day it went out of business in 1916. 4 decades. Wherever he took that show, in rain or in shine, in sickness or in health, drunk or broke, the Pony Express went with him. It was like a little skit. Queen Victoria came out of mourning to see the rider of the Pony Express. And the Pope allowed the Pony Express to come to Vatican City. When Buffalo Bill got done, no one would remember that the Pony Express was a colossal failure and a madcap idea that had lost money from the day it began. They would remember only, as we remember today, that it is this enduring and endearing memory of a West that I think we think of as a West that might have been, the West that should have been. I spent a number of years in the West researching this book, and I have to tell you by way of introduction that after a long while it began to occur to me there had not been a book on the Pony Express in a half a century, so that seemed like a good idea for a book. And what I found in researching it was that no one wrote a book about the Pony Express for 50 years after it went out of business. And that writer was an alcoholic newspaper man who called himself Colonel William Lightfoot Visscher. He was not a colonel, but that's another story. His research and his legal address were the Chicago Press Club Bar. And when the colonel got done, all the handiwork of Twain and Cody would be enhanced. And so I found the story puzzling. And I asked an old man who was with the National Pony Express Association in western Nebraska, named August Borkland. He's a saddle maker. I said, Mr. Borkland, I'm finding the story appears not to be true. A lot of these things appear to have been made up and embellished and exaggerated. And Mr. Borkland said to me, Mr. Corbett, we do not lie out here. We remember big. and that is the American West that interests me, and I think my friend and my colleague, Alan Sargent, a West where Americans remember big. Bernard DeVoto, the great historian, believed that when you cross the wide Missouri River, the stories just got bigger, and that's the kind of story I'm talking about, a bit like a fishing story, and the fish just got a little bigger every year. When I researched this book, I will tell you this, and then I'll let Colin say a word. I met many Americans who told me that their great-great-great-grandfathers had ridden for the Pony Express across the 8 states from Missouri to California, including Kansas and Nebraska, Colorado, Wyoming, Utah, Nevada. I met so many Americans whose great-great-great-grandfathers had ridden for the Pony Express that after a while it occurred to me that they would have never needed to actually use horses. They could have simply lined everyone up and passed the mail back and forth by hand. It's that kind of memory in the American West. You often meet people in the West who will tell you that their great-great-great-grandfathers rode for the Pony Express in Wisconsin or Minnesota. States not touched by the Pony Express. All images of the Pony Express that we have are wrong, and that does not impede the story one bit. The Orphans Preferred is a celebration of America's affection for a tall tale, and whether you're looking at the films of the illustrations of Frederick Remington or countless illustrators who wish they were Frederick Remington, and Frederick Remington was the great painter of the Pony Express, and he never saw the Pony Express. Or the filmmaker John Ford, who came from this city. John Ford put Pony Express in every movie that he made, not everyone, but nearly everyone. My favorite is Fort Apache, the great cavalry trilogy film. Some of you may know this. The film begins with the rider of the Pony Express thundering into Fort Apache to bring the news of Custer's last stand to the brave men at the fort. The problem with that is that Custer's Last Stand took place in 1876, 15 years after the Pony Express went out of business. But John Ford loved that memory, and he put that in his movie, and that's the kind of story we're talking about. So thanks for coming over here, and I'll introduce you to Colin Sargent, who will share his story with you.
All right. I really love the idea of flirting with the borderline of truth and fable, because the closer I got to this lecture, the more I've wondered if I've ever been close enough to see the border. Because first of all, I think we're all fabulous. And I think that fable is kind of like a potato that you skin, and then you cut out the eyes, so there's something that is ready to consume. Another way to look at fable maybe is an old rabbit's foot keeps us so comfortable, that lucky rabbit's foot that we keep in our pockets. We stroke it, we feel a smooth, reassuring feel, and slowly the rabbit fur drops away, and now you're smoothing this bone down that you have. And when we're down to pure bone, we're down to fable. I think the truth and fable isn't just happening back in Pony Express days or when Jean-Baptiste Charbonneau was being carried on Sacagawea's back. I'm not sure there's ever been an objective truth. And it's interesting to consider that. Something happened yesterday that made me wonder about it again. Rutgers University, I don't know if any of you read into this tidbit, but it crested on the internet yesterday. Rutgers University paid $32,000 for Toni Morrison to come and do a reading and presentation. And Chris and I would like you to know we're getting something less than $25,000. But thousands of years from now, when people go and look at the records to find the truth, they will find written down that Rutgers paid Snooki $32,000. So if you look and go straight to the facts, I went right to the journals to find out the truth. You'll find that someone peeling the cultural layers back would consider Snooki a more impressive person visiting Rutgers than Toni Morrison. And of course, that's a matter of opinion, but people's valuing of the truth is something that interests me. Before I wrote Museum of Human Beings, I wondered who would be in the back seat of rooms like this. There's always that person I imagine saying, well, is that true? And Tim O'Brien had a wonderful thing. He spoke at University of Maine at Orono. And in his book, The Things They Carried, a Vietnam soldier from America stepped on a mine. His name was Kurt Lemon, and blew up into a million pieces into a tree. And in the story, his fellow soldiers are picking the remains out from the tree, and one of them unconsciously starts humming Lemon Tree. Now you know the song, Lemon Tree. This is a vocal presentation too, so they're singing Lemon Tree and picking pieces of lemon down, and that person who's always in the back of the audience, collectively across time, says, well, is that true? And Tim O'Brien said, it's better than the truth. I worked on it. And the idea of our need for something to be true is what the human projection is. Now, if you just have a bunch of facts and you don't cook them at all, you don't have that human projection, like an astronomer would look into the sky and see these distantly named stars that have alphanumeric symbols but are lacking in charm. But it takes a human being to look up there and say, you know, if you squint that pattern up there, it kind of looks like the Big Dipper. That's where you get the idea And there's a famous phrase about that, is that fiction is the lie that tells the truth. Now, the first time I ever heard that, Dennis Lehane told it to me while I was a student at the Stone Coast MFA. And I thought that was really great, but then I checked into it, and I found out he cribbed it from Hemingway, who had cribbed it from Pablo Picasso, who said, art is the lie that tells the truth. And I see all these layers of pearls, these layers of accretion on the big truth. And I would change fiction as the lie that tells the truth. I love it. I think it informs. But you could spin off of it and say, history is the truth that tells the lie. And I'll give you an example to that person in the collective back of the room. We were all happy to think of Sacagawea as living well into her 80s, with her raven hair streaming behind her, dying finally at, reportedly, Wind River Reservation. We like all of our victims to lead full lives. And the towering biography by a historically well-credentialed author carried her well into her 80s. And then there was just one moment, something happened, like the Joseph Heller book, something happened, and all of a sudden, Sacagawea is reported in Encyclopedia Britannica, another template for the truth. It must be true. Encyclopedia Britannica as dying in 25, just 25 years old of an adult disease. So we have these varying Sacagaweas, these varying ways of telling the tale. And what I think I'll do is, I'm not planning on doing any reading, but there's a background on Museum of Human Beings that talks about the photo op that history really is, and also it's a big part of what you leave out. And then, so I'll read that and then hand it back over to you. I have a distant prop, and I never find it when I reach for it. You've all seen the Sacagawea gold piece? It's funny, I bought some for some of the readings that I was doing, and I went to the lady at the bank, and she said, I used to be a high school English teacher, and so this coin means a lot to me, too. So we've got a whole bunch of those Sacagaweas. And I thought, wait a minute, we like to change history into what do we want to make it to be? The big movie about the Lewis and Clark expedition, and here we have the truth framed into it got past the critics, it met with everybody's taste, showed Charlton Heston as William Clark and Fred McMurray as Meriwether Lewis. Toussaint Charbonneau, the French-Canadian trapper, who's Jean-Baptiste's father and Sacagawea's rapist husband, he was played by the person who ended up being the voice of Fred Flintstone. And Sergeant Gass, if anybody is really boning up on the Lewis and Clark expedition, was played by William Demarest, who ended up being Uncle Charlie on My Three Sons. So we force our templates of familiarity so that we can accept something that was bigger or different than we can even bring into our ken. When we look at this coin, oh, I forgot to tell you who played Sacagawea. Does anybody know? Donna Reed. And I think she said Sacagawea because she really hoped that there would be a new movie coming out with Julia Roberts playing. When we look at this coin, or any of the other images of Sacagawea that take us back to elementary school, we're treated to a defining moment that shows her smiling serenely at the Pacific's edge, wearing an iconic fashion accessory on her back. Sort of the way Paris Hilton is photographed with Tinkerbell tucked under her arm. The photo op is very comforting. Mission accomplished comes to mind. Until you wonder, was there any cost to Princess Sacagawea for betraying her knowledge of the woods to benefit these famous explorers, Lewis and Clark? And wait, isn't there actually another person on our so-called Sacagawea coin? Whatever happened to this little boy, the expedition papoose, that son of a celebrity mom? The question and the unfinished myth haunted me. He had to have had a life of his own beyond our reductive history, and there really are no single defining moments in a person's life, even though it's popular in fiction to use that as a storytelling device. I've always thought it's more a series of choices or paths. So I started checking into this. Turns out after the expedition, William Clark took Sacagawea with her son home to St. Louis with him as souvenirs. He built a big white house and a personal museum filled with artifacts from the voyage of discovery to showcase his triumphs and to make sure he had complete control of the way his story was being told. He married his 17-year-old cousin so he'd have a proper hostess for illustrious guests, but continued his explorations with Sacagawea out back in a little shack he kept beside the slave quarters. The child in the papoose has a name, Jean-Baptiste. His father, Toussaint Charbonneau, was more Sacagawea's rapist than her husband. Clark struck a deal with the crusty trapper, buying Janie, as he called her, a popular slur for camp followers, for $500.33 and promising her he'd provide for the education of the little boy he nicknamed Pomp. Now here's where the truth gets so unsavory, it would never have made it into the school books. Though there were plenty of fake Sacagaweas running around like fake Elvises, willing to step up and play the role, the real-life heroine did not live well into her 80s on Wind River Reservation, with the wind streaming through her raven hair, no matter how much we wanted to believe it. The daughter of a sachem died at age 25 of an adult disease. We don't know if it was syphilis or some variant, but she disappears in 1812 from the Clark compound. And Clark is left with this precocious boy who grows into a confused and angry teenager beginning to get in the way. So Clark negligently palms Baptiste off on a German prince. Problem solved. Who's traveling through the United States in the company of a smarmily comic artist, the pair always in search of the next new thing. Duke Paul is in the process of earning a reputation as a botanist and chemist, but also a bit of a sexual tourist, who's doing all he can to delay his inevitable arranged marriage to Sophie to cement a political alliance. Again, Baptiste finds himself somebody's souvenir. Crossing the Atlantic in January 1824 aboard the brig Smyrna, Duke Paul takes Baptiste to the capitals of Europe and parades him around as a half gentleman, half savage. The Continentals are convinced his mother's expertise, which he somewhat inherited, couldn't possibly be intelligence, but had instead to be due to some sort of physical anomaly, like having extra magnetite in his skull for direction finding. So he's displayed as some sort of freak in Versuch stadiums for phrenologists to study. Both as an experiment and an entertainment, the Europeans set about educating the savage. Reeling from a life of sex, drugs, and a little bit of the Ludwig von, to borrow from A Clockwork Orange, Baptiste returns to the New World an accomplished musician, the master of at least 7 languages, and one hell of a hangover from the many compromises he's had to make to negotiate his way through deepest, darkest civilization in the Old World. He's wondering if he can fit in anywhere, embarking on a search for a place in American society as a mixed race patriot. But meanwhile, he's got a bone to pick with Clark. And that's the dramatic situation. Clark couldn't even speak English when he said, "Ocean in view, oh the joy," which got put on quarters. He wasn't looking at the Pacific Ocean. He was looking at an estuary widening of the river, and there was fog outside. But we all wanted him to say, "Ocean in view, oh the joy." We also wanted him to spell it right. Imagine if you had one word to spell right and you're William Clark, wouldn't you think maybe it would be ocean? O-C-I-E-N. And when they came out with a coin, the person at the mint corrected it. And there's that healing process of history, the layers of the pearls, and said, "Ocean in view, oh the joy." And again, it wasn't the ocean. And she said, when she was confronted by it by NPR, she said, "I didn't want everybody to think I couldn't spell ocean." It's all yours.
The borderland of fable, which is what Colin is talking about, is that place where fact and fancy collide. And there's a great deal of that in American history. If you think about it, it's Paul Revere's Ride, and it's the Alamo, and it's Custer's Lost Stand. And there's quite a difference between what happened and what someone said happened. A lot of that in terms of the stories of the Pony Express and the story of Sacagawea, and I have actually seen Sacagawea's grave. I was driving across Wyoming one day, and I saw a sign that said, "Sacagawea's grave," in the Wind River Mountains near Fort Washakie. So I thought I'd go and have a look at it. So then afterwards I found out that she might not be buried there. But if you follow the New York Times stories last year, you know that no one is entirely sure where Sitting Bull is buried. And many towns in the Dakotas claim him. And when the Sioux are asked where he is, they say, "He's everywhere." An interesting thing about what Colin's talking about is what is called spectacle anthropology, which is the idea of exhibiting people as what we would call freaks. And the other book that I have out right now is a story about the Chinese in the American West called The Poker Bride. And it is about a woman who was won in a poker game in Warrens, Idaho by a Connecticut Yankee gambler. And she lived until 1933. Her story seems like it sprung from the stories of Bret Hart, like the outcasts of Poker Flat, but there's actually a great deal more truth in that. Where the spectacle anthropology comes into play, which I think is kind of interesting, is before the California Gold Rush, most Americans are surprised to find that if an American had seen a Chinese person in this country before 1849, they had probably seen them in a freak show. And the two most famous Chinese of the 19th century were Chang and Eng, the Siamese twins. They were actually ethnically Chinese. They came into the port of Boston in the fall of 1829, and they lived until 1874, and they made a great living. They were very successful and actually wealthy, being professional freaks. And as professional freaks, Americans were glad to see the Chinese. You could pay the equivalent of a week's wages and stand in line for half a day in Boston to see what they referred to as a Chinaman eat with chopsticks or use an abacus. It was only when they began to come in significant numbers that people began to become alarmed. And that's an interesting part of the story of this saga. You may remember that on the 28th of January, 1848, James Wilson Marshall picked up a piece of gold half the size of a garden pea at a mill he was building on the American River near Sacramento, California. And that event would be the event that would launch the California Gold Rush. On the morning that happened, there were 260 white men, which is how they counted people, living on the Pacific slope. And 12 years later, when the Pony Express began, there were 500,000 people living in California, which is the great migration of men and women in our history. The stories that interest us are things that are rooted in fact, I think, and layered with fabrication, embellishment, and outright lies, as my introducer recalls. The words of William Floyd, who was the first historian of the Pony Express, who said, after examining it for a long time, it's a tale of truth, of half-truth, and no truth at all. Everyone else who looked at the story concluded the same things. It often surprises people to know that in the matter of the Pony Express, no one is sure who the first rider out of St. Joseph, Missouri was on the day that started. Now that seems an odd thing, don't you think? That no one would bother to write down the name of that rider. Very odd. There's a great deal of debate in the West about this. They can tell you the color of the horse, but they can't tell you the name of that rider. It's that kind of story. In part, what explains it in the matter of the Pony Express is that because the business was only operational for a very short period of time and no one wrote anything down, after a while, things began to take on a life of their own, and it began to be what people wanted to remember. And that's, I think, very true in the matter of the 19th century West. The story of the poker bride is a story of the Chinese concubine who died in 1933, and we know she came into the United States in 1874, smuggled into the port of San Francisco on a ship in a compartment, and she lived for 50 years in a remote mining camp in Idaho. And when she appears back in civilization in the 1920s, her arrival back into civilization was an event all the newspapers invoked Washington Irving's Rip Van Winkle. It was one of those kinds of things. Here was someone, if you remember when they used to find Japanese soldiers on islands in the South Pacific long after the war, here was a reminder of the 19th century West that was a piece of a lost time. A woman's name was Polly Bemis. We know a lot about her because we know about her from the end of her life. She was interviewed a great deal. When she was interviewed as an old lady, she says, very typical of the experience of Chinese women in the 19th century in this country, her family sold her because they were starving during the famine. They sold her for a lot of money. And she oddly thought nothing, she didn't think there was anything odd about that at all. I suppose people I know who are Chinese and who study the history of the Chinese in the 19th century say that it belays a kind of stoicism that was very common, that someone was willing to put up with that kind of an experience. So Polly Bemis is the person who Mark Twain says we ought write about a man, not write about mankind. She's that kind of person. She's a real person who puts a human face on an experience that we know a lot about, but we don't have a real person to identify this. And because she lived so long, she survived an experience that ought to have killed her. She survived the sex slave trade. And in the 19th century, the survival rate for that was very, very low. You didn't live long in a brothel in the American West. She was just a person who got lucky. And because of that, she lived to be a very old lady. Anyway, she is a sort of beloved folk figure in the state of Idaho, where people are rather evenly divided between whether or not her story is completely true, or whether her story is, like the story of the Pony Express, heavily freighted with fabrications, embellishments, and outright lies. But that's the kind of story that we're talking about. I think we'd be delighted to answer some questions if you have questions about how it is that American history got to be so confusing. It's something that continues to interest me. I know the story of Sacagawea and many of the places in the West that claim her, which is another interesting matter. So if anyone has any, yes, please.
So does your book kind of sort out what is back in the Pony Express?
Yes, it does. what I thought was interesting when I wrote the story, The Pony Express, was this. Is I thought there were two ways to look at the story. First, I look at the story of The Pony Express in terms of what we know happened at the time, since it only took place for a very brief period of time. And then I look at its afterlife. And its afterlife is a colossus. The actual business was very brief, wildly unsuccessful, and a kind of madcap idea. If any of you know anything about business at all, as a business model, I did a piece for the Wall Street Journal this year on the anniversary of the Pony Express, and the editor of the Wall Street Journal said to me, "You know, it's probably America's most famous failed business." And it is that. But we don't remember that sort of thing about it. What's interesting about it is its afterlife was extraordinary, and that had to do with the people who got a hold of the story. We have a lot of eyewitness accounts of things. The great British explorer Richard Burton was traveling in the American West at the time of the Pony Express, and he actually saw the Pony Express in operation, and his accounts of it are very detailed. He was a compulsive note taker who wrote everything down. So he tells us that horses were so valuable to the Pony Express that they let the horse sleep inside the station at night and made the men sleep outside, so nothing would happen to the horse. I like that kind of thing. I believe Burton's correct. I think that's probably accurate. I don't know that you can ever sort out the whole story. All the books that were written about it tended to repeat all the things that had been printed before. So it took on a kind of wild energy. Much of it wasn't true. People tend to believe these sorts of things. In fact, I can tell you through the wonders of the internet, which is why this is a good question, but the wonders of the internet, I monitor the Pony Express every day. And every day, somewhere in America, someone prints or says something about the Pony Express that is complete nonsense. And it cheers me immeasurably to see those things. But and I used to once in a while send someone an email, and I gave up after a while. It seemed a fool's errand, and you know, people believe what they want to believe. People believe extraordinary things. One of the great things that they believe is that the rider of the Pony Express galloped, you know, like Dancer's Image coming down the final stretch of, you know, and that's completely preposterous. If you know anything at all about riding, they were riding night and day in all kinds of weather, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, across 8 states and every imaginable terrain, snow, desert, past herds of buffalo. It's actually dangerous to ride a horse at that speed. But every image you see of the Pony Express shows men galloping. And another image that is very common, and people often ask me about this, is the image of the Pony Express rider being chased by wild red men and savages. You've probably seen that. Yes, surely you have. Yes, I know you have, because I've seen countless images of this. There isn't a single shard of fact in that story. Why would an American Indian want a 3-week-old copy of the New York Tribune? Think about that. There was nothing the rider of the Pony Express carried with him that was of any value. But in memory, all of those images are incredibly powerful. Those are powerfully exciting images. The reality is that there is no evidence of anybody ever getting killed by an Indian riding for the Pony Express. And there's no evidence of anybody dying, actually, or even there's all these arguments about what happened to the mail, but they generally did a pretty good job of moving the mail across the country. They just couldn't, on the matter of the business model, they just simply could not carry enough mail on the back of a horse to make the business pay. It's not that complicated. It cost $5 to send a letter across America in 1860-61. That was the equivalent of a week's wages for a common laborer in Kansas. So you see, economically, it was a nutty idea. They just simply, that horse could not do it. He couldn't possibly do it. You're changing horses every 10 miles. You're changing riders every 100 miles. As a business model, think about it. But it's a wonderful memory. Old men who rode for the Pony Express, and there were plenty of them, they were boys when they rode, who were interviewed in the 1920s and 30s in the American West, always remembered one thing, and that wasn't being chased by Indians or whatever. how cold it was. And if you think about it, that's probably a very accurate memory. What it was like to ride across Wyoming in the winter at night. So I'm happy to answer other questions. All the answers I don't have, he has. So, yes?
Like the Chinese men who worked on the Intercontinental Railroad, they are voluntarily or with what they called indentured servants.
Yeah, thank you. That's a very good question. Americans are often confused about how the Chinese came to America. The Chinese, one of the things that often amazes people in the 21st century is that the news that James Marshall found a piece of gold half the size of a pea on the American River reached Hong Kong before it reached Boston. That astonishes people. And the Chinese were on the next boat. They called California Golden Mountain, and they were looking to make some money and go home. The immigrants were almost all what we would call a peasant class from the southern part of China, the Pearl River Delta. They were almost all male. The women who tended to come with them were essentially sex slaves for a robust prostitution industry, which, as shocking as it may seem, no one seemed to think was very unusual, including the Chinese at the time. They first came to mine. The railroad didn't get rolling, if you remember, until after the American Civil War. The Transcontinental Railroad wasn't completed until the end of the 1860s. So you had different waves of Chinese. They tended to come on what was called the credit ticket system, and we know a fair bit about this. You would sell your mother's, you'd sell the water buffalo or pawn your mother's jewelry and buy a ticket to come to Golden Mountain. And then you might owe someone some money. But they were not what was called in the 19th century, and the word is incorrectly used, they were never coolies. They were not slaves. They were free men who came and went of their own will, and some of them made money. The early miners in California, the Chinese, which is a very common thing if you think of it, they made money and they went back to China, and they said, I went to Golden Mountain and I got rich. And so other people thought, what a swell idea, and they went to Golden Mountain too. At first they were very well received. In fact, one of my favorite anecdotes about the Chinese in America is the Annals of San Francisco. The very earliest account of the Chinese in the American West, 1851, reports, Americans like Chinese food. It's cheap and tasty. Isn't that an interesting fact? At a time where Americans weren't really sure how they felt about the Chinese, they liked Chinese food.
I have a question.
Yes, certainly.
Well, is that true?
It is true. One of the reasons that we know that Chinese food is popular in the mining camps and in San Francisco is that it's relatively inexpensive. Everything that was available in the American West in the 19th century had to come from someplace else. So tools that were made in the East and came on a ship from Boston or New York were expensive. Things were often expensive. And so in the early days, I think that's true. I also would point out, too, that there was not a town of any size in the American West from Deadwood to Denver, fly-blown hellholes to large cities that did not have Chinese restaurants and Chinese laundries. And part of the reason for that is that in China, men did not do the laundry. But in the American West, it was something that they could do that was regarded as non-competitive, although there was occasionally some chafing there, but that was the reason for that. But all across the West, if you see the archives of state historical archives in Nevada or Utah, you see photographs of Chinese laundries and Chinese restaurants, and the food was, of course, as you know today, was something that they thought white folks would want to eat.
Well, I don't know, because I've seen every episode of Bonanza.
There you go.
And I never saw Hop Sing making Chinese food for over a year.
He never did.
I thought it was a dietary restriction.
That's a little known fact. Thank you. Somebody else had their hand up. Do you have any questions for us? If not, he's my shill. Yes, please. Yes, sir.
Well, my question has to, both of you seem to indicate that there's something particular to the American myth. Do you think it's in some qualitative way different than myths from other cultures and other countries? Is there any other than the basis that it starts from?
I think that
didn't Jack London write this great story, Nambok the Liar, where he goes and sees a freighter and has a big memory when he's talking about that? I think that it's universal to the human condition that we make our history what we want it to be. I have one anecdote about that. When I was finishing Museum of Human Beings, I was just going through the final galleys when Fort Clatsop burned to the ground. And I don't know if you guys know Fort Clatsop, but on the on the West Coast, when the Lewis and Clark expedition went for that very cold winter, just before the one that they went through the Pony Express, that cold winter at the Pacific's edge, there was a place called Fort Clatsop. And it became a National Historic Monument. Just like at Fort Western in Augusta, all of the prevailing scholars were brought together and they used hand adds timbers to put it in exactly the place where the Lewis and Clark journals said that the Lewis and Clark expedition stayed. And you know, there's a kind of a creosoted history that we have from the National Park Service, and they did it right, and it was very comforting, where it was exactly where it was supposed to be. You drive to it, it was exactly what Lewis and Clark had, except there was a bathroom. And I want to let you know, Sacagawea would have really appreciated, you know, having that ladies room there. And so it was the kind of place that people went across the country to discover their history. I know my family, growing up on Albion Street in Portland, when we went to some historic place, we'd pack up a car we called the Bluebird. We would take boiled eggs and fried chicken and covering it with tin foil. I think that's part of the history, too. We clamber into this car and say, "We're going to see old Fort Clatsop." You know, my parents were doing me a favor. Something was being handed off to me, an understanding, really a set of prejudices. But we got into the car and we went across the country to old Fort Clatsop. And so now that all these layers of loving old Fort Clatsop, when old Fort Clatsop burned to the ground, they didn't know what to do. Right. We burned down an icon. Right. So immediately, imagine the Victoria Mansion burning down. Rushing to the fore was the friends of old Fort Clatsop. We're going to build old Fort Clatsop, and we're going to make history better than it ever was. So they started. They had the hand adds, timbers, and they did everything else right. And this time, it was handicapped accessible. So old Fort Clatsop was just the way it wasn't from the very beginning. And they were about to start and move the first, you know, those little bobcats and bulldozers. They were just about to start. They had their hard hats on. They had all the money ready. And one scientist said, "Before you rebuild old Fort Clatsop, I really hate to tell you this." He didn't hate it at all. "I really hate to tell you this, but you have to move it 9/10 of a mile upstream, because this isn't where history tells you old Fort Clatsop was." And the friends, we extend that metaphor as far as well, the friends of history, the friends, the comforted, zoned friends of old Fort Clatsop said, "Well, that's terrible. We can't do that. 9/10 of a mile upriver? That's off park land." History is so often park land. Off park land. And so you know what George W. Bush did? He just waved a wand and extended the borders of the park, so that the new place would be on parkland. And that was fine. I really like the idea of scholarship, our modern scholarship, infallible as it might be. That was fine. I accepted that until the historian decided to spike the ball. And he said, "You know how I know where old Fort Clatsop really was? I've looked at NASA photographs to see the worried Earth change, and the hand of man changing and looking down." And I thought, NASA, there's just another template for our unquestionable, unquestioned believing of what someone is telling us. Just like it's, just like 100 years before then, that person might have said, "God told me where the original Fort Clatsop was." Now, our new God, NASA, you know, because we all drank the Tang, NASA told me, in spite of whatever terrible tragedies happened with NASA, NASA told me that's where old Fort Clatsop is. And further, I know it because I followed the Mercury.
mercury was a cure for syphilis, and only someone bankrolled like Thomas Jefferson, not that he was great at handling money, but Thomas Jefferson, like the Lewis and Clark expedition, would have mercury levels treating syphilis consistent for 33 men and a dog as they went across. So there's this shining path of American history where they knew all the mercury was, and he was neck deep in all of these encampments in the night soil studying it. I was really there. I was really finding the truth. The idea of going to source information like night soils and getting the truth is a huge part of the hocus pocus. A lot of times people will say, well, you really enjoyed going and doing research and everything for Museum of Human Beings. And I really did enjoy it. But there's a need, I think, for some people to be told that I did things. When I went to another historical novelist doing a talk like this, it was a wonderful writer, very credentialed, named William H. White, who did a neat story about the HMS Pandora. Does anybody know about that ship? There had to be a ship assigned to trail after Fletcher Christian and the mutineers on the Bounty. And this untold story, it appealed to me because I liked the story about a little Jean-Baptiste Charbonneau growing up. We never accorded him an adulthood. And the same thing with the Pandora. So the Pandora chased the Bounty all across the seven seas and looked for something that wasn't there, Pitcairn Island. And it was a fabulous metaphor for just postmodern humanity. So I love the idea, but then that person in the back of the room asked William H. White, well, is this all true? And he said, and he was a pro, he's written 50 books. He said, true? I went to Tahiti, and I felt the volcanic ash on the beach, the same ones, the same beach, the same crystals of sand that that the crew of the Pandora had so many years ago. And I saw the guy in the back of the crowd going, eating out of his hand. And then he said, to understand the way the rum trade went for my many books, I bought a vacation place in the Caribbean so I could watch rum grow. And Jim Nelson, the historical novelist, was there, and he'd been polite up until then. And he said, watching rum grow, I want to know where that island is because I'm there. And William H. White, he's no slowpoke. He looked at Jim and he said, sugarcane is rum on the hoof.
Well, I would agree that I think, you know, if you think about it, the story of Joan of Arc and the story of Robin Hood are examples of this in other places. I could tell you about the one thing about the Pony Express. The route of the Pony Express was 2,000 miles long. And there is, if you drive across Nebraska today, anybody ever driven across Nebraska, you'll see signs that say, next exit, authentic Pony Express station. They're strung out along Interstate 80. There are a number of these. The problem with that story is that the Pony Express ran to the south bank of the Platte River. In 1860, Nebraska was hardly settled at all. There were no towns. All the towns on the north bank of the Platte River were railroad towns that the Union Pacific developed in the 1870s and 80s. But many of these towns, my favorite is Gothenburg, which is a town full of Swedes, and Cozad, which is another town nearby, right near the 100th Meridian, they both have authentic Pony Express stations in the town. Though the Pony Express never went through the town, as there was no town there. People in the town told me that they thought the Lions Club or somebody thought the town needed something back in the 1930s, and they dragged an old farm building into town on the back of a sled and set it up. But, you know, you don't get into that kind of an argument with people. I mean, I'm not kidding you about that. There's places, no one is really certain about a lot of that stuff. The title of the book is Orphans Preferred, and I'll just end by saying this. There is not a gift shop in the American West from St. Joseph, Missouri to Sacramento, California, where you cannot buy an authentic Pony Express recruiting poster that says, wanted, young, skinny, wiry fellows willing to risk death daily, and so forth and so on, and saying, Orphans Preferred. Now, that's a pretty exciting poster, and people like to buy that poster. But I trace that to 1926 to Sunset Magazine in California and a writer there who basically made this story up. Because you cannot find in any newspaper published in California in 1860 and 61 any ad that resembles that at all. But that's the ad we want to remember. And in the matter of truth and what isn't true, Cody, Bill Cody, who all his biographies, all his autobiographies were ghostwritten by dime novelists like Prentice Ingraham and Colonel Visscher. And at the end of his life, he told his manager he no longer was sure what was true. And he died in 1917, and his sisters, and they loved Billy, they called him Billy, they outlived him. And they all said afterwards, why, Billy never did any of those things at all. So Cody always claimed to have ridden for the Pony Express, and there is not a shard of evidence of him running for the Pony Express. But he enriched his CV. And who among us has not committed that sin?
Oh, and speaking about the CVs, you know, they have that model of you tell a child and they whisper to the next child and they whisper to the next child. And I was thinking the only way to make that change and warp the final result more is to have not children but tenure track historians.
Yes.
thank you very much for coming.
Thank you.
This podcast was brought to you by the Maine Humanities Council, with support from the National Endowment for the Humanities and friends like you. Thanks for listening, and thanks for your support.